The Bastards of Boston Baseball Podcast.
Back to Folk. Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champion. Game over, series over, and the Red Sox are world champs again.
Yes, indeed. Here it comes. Another edition of the Bastards of Boston Baseball.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the Bastards of Boston Baseball. The Red Sox just finished a four-game set against the New York Yankees, losing three games out of four. They now stand at 500 at 75-75, and they are still 4.5 games out of a wild card spot. I'm your host, Jason Kelly, coming to you from Canton, Massachusetts. If you want to bug me on Twitter, you can find me at Color of the Iris. Joining me on the show from Boca Raton, Florida, is Jeremy Schilling. Jeremy, how are we doing?
Frustrated with Boston sports today, so not great.
Yeah, tough day all around. Red Sox season is imploding. Patriots lose their first game of the season, so not a lot of happy folk up here in Massachusetts, and that's to be expected. Jeremy, if people want to find you on Twitter, where can they find you?
They can find me at JTShill20 on Twitter.
Sounds good. Also with us on the show from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, by way of Windham, Maine, is Terry Cushman. Terry, how are you?
I have a vicious cold, so bear with me throughout the show. If I get into a coughing fit, I apologize. I'm the only one without a mute button. If it gets terrible, we've got Steve McGreevy with us, available for long relief if I do have to tap out, but I'm pretty confident I'll at least get through the first show. And I thought I was going to avoid this. My girlfriend brought it home like a week ago, and it was like on day five or six when it finally got me. I thought I was like, thought I was in the clear, but I think on Friday I really came down with it. So yeah, I sound like I'm going to swear. I sound like shit. Sorry, Charlie.
We'll put one in the swear jar, but I think it's allowed. I think after this weekend, it's allowed. And honestly, I think it's just the Red Sox are making us sick. I was sick 2 weeks ago. You know, it's just kind of going around. It's the way the team's going. You know, it's making us all sick.
The team is like a chronic illness at this point.
It really is. Yeah, we tune in every night and it doesn't get any better. So,
what's so frustrating is it's been there for the taking and we just can't move forward. It's very frustrating.
It really is. Like, and that's the most disappointing part is they're going to look back, and especially at the month of September, there's so many games you left on the table that they could have won. You know, they could have made up ground. Again, you know, early in the month, Kansas City was losing games like a habit, and you couldn't gain ground. You were losing to teams like Detroit. You lost to Arizona. Like, it just it all, you know, just it piled up. And that's what happens when you don't take advantage of opportunities. You fall behind, then you have to go to New York, play the Yankees for four. As much as we like to bag on them, the Yankees are going to the playoffs. They're going to be playing in October. And you went up against them and you got exposed. So you lose three of four. You're now 4.5 out. 4.5 for this team feels like they're 10 out. Like, it feels like it's officially over. And I don't know about you guys. I was looking at this weekend. I said, you know what? If they pull off a surprise, maybe win three or four, maybe they get some breaks along the way, I might be willing to say they're still alive. But losing three or four at this point, I'm ready to say it's officially over. And I know that, you know, Nick on the midweek has said it was over after the Arizona series. I can't really disagree with him on that. I think a lot of fans knew that the season was pretty much over well before this weekend, but this really solidified it. I mean, you know, Houck goes down, he gets scratched from his start. The offense still doesn't produce enough. And you just go up against the Yankees team that overmatches you. And that's why they're heading to the postseason and you're not. So to me, it was the final nail.
I mean, you look at the series, you lose three out of four. Very easily, you could have won three out of four. I mean, you've got a 1-1 game going into extras in game one. That's a winnable game. Friday night's game, you're up 4-0 in the seventh inning, and then you give up a five spot between Zach Kelly and Cam Boozer. You know, Judge put up four of those on a grand slam. And the crazy thing was those first two games, the Yankees were just golfing them. They weren't trying to put the ball in play. Like, the secret sauce behind the Red Sox is they put the ball in play. They've led the league in doubles the last 2 years. Haven't made the playoffs, mostly because of pitching. But the Yankees are just so one-dimensional in that batter's box. So you could have won those two games. You win Saturday easily. You know, today in the finale wasn't a blowout, but you lose that one. So it's just the underachievement here in September from an offensive standpoint has been brutal.
And that's really the surprising part, because the offense was good pretty much most of the year. I mean, the offense carried you at times. You know, the starting pitching carried you to start the year. Then that kind of faltered. They kind of set back a little bit. And then the offense was red hot in the middle of summer, June and July, and even parts of August. They were red hot. Devers was hot. Duran was doing his thing. Like, they were good. Now it's just in September, they're stone cold. And that's the wrong time to go cold for an offense, especially for a team that needs every single win to keep them in it. So it's, you know, that's part of just go back to the whole flawed roster thing that we've been talking about all year. When you have a flawed roster like that, it shows up. Your offense will go cold if it's not structured properly, which it's not. So that's what has kind of done them in. And unfortunately, they head to New York, they lose 3 out of 4, and it's just ugly, and you know, they're pretty much done. So but we will press on, and we will continue to cover them as we usually do. So it's Studs and Duds week, and obviously they lose 3 out of 4, so we're going to start with the duds. We're going to lead right off with that. So Jeremy, you're in the leadoff spot. Who is your dud for the weekend?
Gerrit Cole being just an absolute coward POS. There's no other way to give this take. I don't think anybody in this chat's going to disagree with me, but so for those of you that don't know, Gerrit Cole has been absolutely owned by Rafael Devers, and it was highlighted in a Sunday night ESPN game. I think it was an ESPN game where Devers hit two bombs off him. One of them was like 10 inches off the plate. And it was just so obvious and loud with the way they were discussing it going into that game. And then his performance in that game was epic. So this is how Gerrit Cole responds in his first time facing Rafael Devers. Throws a strike purely for smoke and mirrors. He has no intent to get through the at-bat. Next pitch hits him. Now, credit to Rafael Devers. He probably, one, knew it was coming. Two, he isn't going to give the rise that Cole wants. He just goes to first base. Next time up, this coward POS gives the old hand signal, 4 balls, and sends him to first base with nobody on base. And then we get to him. So it, like, you know, it justice was served. But I mean, what a loser way to handle it. What an absolute loser. You know, and he's not having the same year, and I think he's on the downside of his career, or at least going downhill. And I love that he's got years left, and he's going to be just suck the life out of the money in New York, because the way he handled this cannot be something anyone else in the league respects. I have to believe the people in his own clubhouse don't respect the way he handled this. And if he told people going in and they okayed it or ratified it, then it makes anybody else involved look like the same coward POS, in my opinion. You know, you're a professional athlete. Even if he gets the best of you, go give your team a chance. It's just pathetic.
Terry.
So, late 2019, Gerrit Cole signs what at the time was a record starting pitching contract in free agency, $324 million. I think the previous high before that was David Price coming into the 2016 season, 217. So he blows that out of the water. He had had some Cy Young finishes. He might have been runner-up the year Verlander won it. They were both kind of going for it, both when they were Astros. They took the Stiggy stuff away from him in, that must have been 2021. And then in 2023, he wins the Cy Young anyway. What does Gerrit Cole have to worry about? He's probably Cooperstown bound at this point. The dude pouts on the mound. As soon as someone launches one, he throws his arms up in the air. He starts sulking. He paces around the mound. Dude, just get it together. Get it together. Stop crying. I just, if I was a Yankees fan, I would probably hate Gerrit Cole. I probably wouldn't be a Gerrit Cole guy. I wouldn't buy his jersey. I wouldn't be, you know, roasting him on every podcast I did, but I'm just not a fan. The dude's a crybaby. He's kind of like the pitching version of Kevin Youkilis. When something doesn't go his way, he just pouts. And when he plunked Devers, I was kind of watching his body language. It was automatically suspicious because of the history, but looking at the body language, he didn't really seem to be satisfied with it. There wasn't a stare down. Nothing was especially damning about it until the intentional walk. You couldn't hit him twice. I mean, I don't know if the benches would have cleared, but it would have got pretty tense. And Alex Cora had this look on his face that I can't describe. It just, he had this look on his face like he didn't know exactly which emotion to express. He wanted to express some emotions, but he just kind of let it go. But you knew that he knew. He was connecting the dots from the first inning to the fourth inning. And then my favorite thing about it all was Devers takes the intentional walk and he steals the bag. Devers stole a base on Gerrit Cole. And Cole couldn't recover. He still had his epic meltdown anyway. And that's not what you want to, if you're a Yankees fan, you don't want to see that. You're trying to win your first ring in literally 15 years. You don't want to see that. And Cora's post-game interview, he was wound up several hours after it. So there's no reason for Gerrit Cole to conduct himself that way.
And the thing is, you know, what you said about Yankees fans, like if you were them, you wouldn't feel good. And I agree. And I think when Yankees fans, when their team is on top, and they currently are, it's nothing's wrong, you know, sunshine, everything's great, we're going to the playoffs, you know, we're going to win the World Series. But I bet you, if you gave every Yankees fan truth serum and asked them how they felt about Gerrit Cole being there for the next how many years until 2029, they'd say, oh my God, it scares us to death. This guy is making $36 million for the next, God knows, I mean, you know, next like 5-6 years. It's, and like, he's got an opt-out up to 2024. Obviously, he's not going to take that. He's going to keep the money. He has a full no trade. He's getting into his mid-30s. You know, there are a lot of people that didn't believe he's going to even pitch this year because of the injury. And now he's so scared of Rafael Devers that he has to hit him and then intentionally walk him. That's your ace? Like, how do you feel good about going into October baseball if your ace is that scared of an opposing hitter? That would not make me feel good at all. Say what you want about Chris Sale during his time here with Boston, but when he took the mound, he wasn't afraid of anybody. When he was healthy and he was actually out there, he was not afraid of anyone. Gerrit Cole is afraid of hitters. He's afraid of Rafael Devers, and I'll bet you Devers is not the only one. I'm sure there's other guys around the league, maybe Yordan Alvarez, someone like that, that Gerrit Cole just does not want to face. And, you know, hey, in his position, he's got the contract. He's locked in. He's making $36 a year. He's probably sitting there going, I don't have to give up bombs to this guy. Yeah, intentionally walk him. I don't care. Like, it's just, if I'm a Yankees fan, that's not what I want out of my ace. I want a guy that's going to go in there and battle and, you know, is going to stare hitters down and not be afraid of anybody. You're going into October with that guy? Like, it's just, it's part of the reason why, again, the Yankees have a good team this year. They're not going to win it. They won't. Because they just, this is the personalities they have on their team. I think Judge is the only, like, tough, actually, like, competitor that they have on that roster, which is a good thing because he's their best player and they locked him up. But the rest of them, I mean, you're going into October with Jazz Chisholm. You think he's going to lead you to a World Series? You think Alex Verdugo is going to lead you to a World Series? And Juan Soto, I like, but I don't think he's in that Judge area either. I think that he kind of, you know, takes his time off at times and, you know, kind of plays lackadaisical. And then you got Gerrit Cole taking the mound. You've got guys like Cole and Nestor Cortez who thinks that he's Sandy Koufax and he's the furthest thing from it. It's just Cole speaks to a whole larger problem with the Yankees. So, like, they don't have a good culture over there. They really don't. They've got talent, but they have no culture and they have no toughness. And, you know, Boone is the same way. Boone's not tough. He's a player's manager and he lets them kind of do whatever they want. And, you know, he gets outmanaged in the playoffs. And again, it just, you look at a guy like Gerrit Cole, that's your ace. And other teams are not afraid of him because they look at him and go, you're not what you used to be and you're scared of other hitters. So we're going to take advantage of you. I mean, the Red Sox, as bad as their offense has been, and as much as their season is over and they're kind of, you know, in a downward spiral, they put up 7 on that guy. Like, no problem. They had no problem jumping on Gerrit Cole, even though he pitched around Devers. It's just, it's pathetic. So it's kind of laughable at this point. Like, he is a coward, but again, he represents just the whole culture problem there in New York. And that's why they're not going to win it. They won't win it this year. And I don't know if they're going to win it anytime soon because they're stuck with him. They've got a lot of bad money and bad contracts on that team. They'll probably lose Soto because they don't want to pay him. So, you know, this is the year they should do it, but they won't. And he's kind of a microcosm of just everything that's wrong with that team and that organization. Just he's a coward and they kind of are a coward organization. They've got talent, but they won't go that far. So it's just kind of funny to laugh at this point. I mean, if we can't watch the Red Sox in October, we can at least watch Gerrit Cole melt down in October, which will be fun.
Last night, I didn't sleep well because, you know, like I said, I'm not feeling good. I've been coughing all night. But for no reason in particular this morning, I watched the last inning Mariano Rivera ever pitched. And Girardi actually brought him out with 2 outs in the 8th. And then he got that out, came back out for the 9th, and then he got the first 2 outs. And then they went to the bullpen. That way he could kind of have his curtain call, you know, before the game ended while people were still in the stands. And instead of Girardi going out to take the ball from him, he sent out Jeter and Posada, you know, two guys that he'd been teammates with the longest. And he'd pitched to Posada for most of his career also. And despite the intense rivalry, you know, living through 2003, 2004, the ALDS in 2018. In 2017, they came real close to going to the World Series. I was really emotionally invested in the Astros winning that series as well as 2 years later. And despite my hatred for the Yankees, I can't help but love Mariano Rivera. And my eyes well up. I'm like the least sensitive guy on this crew, you know? My memes are the most savage that I'm sharing with people. But, you know, it's a very sentimental thing. And the reason I'm bringing this up is Gerrit Cole should probably watch some Mariano Rivera clips, highlights of his career, what it means to be one of the best in the sport and how to carry yourself. In 2005, we were the defending champions. We played the Yankees in our home opener, and they introduced the Yankees lineup. When it got to Mariano Rivera, the crowd gave a sarcastic cheer. I think even a standing ovation. And rather than throw a hissy fit and have a little meltdown or have a dirty look on his face about it, Mariano just smiled and he tipped his cap to the fans and said, I hope you guys enjoyed it. You know, it's a new season now. And that's what Gerrit Cole needs to be. Who's the best Red Sox pitcher of this century?
Okay, of this century, probably, well, Pedro.
It's got to be Pedro. Who's the best Yankees pitcher of this century?
It's not Gerrit Cole.
I think it is. Honestly. I mean, let's go through them. You could say Clemens, and I won't argue that, but he wasn't there a long time, and he left, and he came back. You know, Tanaka wasn't super great. Sabathia was great in spurts. I really think Cole's the best they've had.
I was going to say, maybe Pettit or Mussina. I'd put Pettit or Mussina over Cole.
Pettit did it forever, guy.
Well, he wasn't like an ace. I think he was like the John Lackey of that staff.
He was a big, big game pitcher. I don't know. To me, that I don't put Pettit and Cole in that same category because Cole's a little
soft. I don't know. Cole's just – he is soft. I can't deny that. But the point I was trying to make, I mean, even if we want to disagree on this, like, he's one of the best of this century, and he needs to act like it.
Give me somebody with less stuff and more balls every single time.
I mean, I'll take a John Lester any day of the week. Don't get me wrong. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And his stuff's not nearly as good as Cole's stuff.
But man, Cole, you know, as Jeremy said, he's starting to kind of slow down a little bit, and it's going to depend on how he adapts, you know, how he can make his stuff better as he loses velo and all that. And the spin rate isn't quite as intense. And, you know, most great pitchers figure that out. Scherzer did, Verlander did. So we'll see, but Cole should just enjoy it at this point and stop being a crybaby.
He's kind of the Alex Rodriguez in pitcher form for the Yankees. Paid a lot of money for him. He's a great talent, but is that a guy that you ever consider to be a leader and a guy that you think you're going to win with? No, probably not. So it's that's kind of how I equate the two. It's just, he's not like, I agree with you. He's not in that Pettit, Mussina group, you know, the Rivera group. He's in the A-Rod group. He's in the group of Yankees that like even Yankee fans want to forget about eventually. So especially if they never win a ring with him, which I don't think they will. So, but we will move on from the Yankees and we'll turn our attention to our own team. So, Terry, you are up next. Who is your dud for the weekend?
I'm kind of going outside the box myself. I'm going with Craig Breslow. And not for the reasons we've all roasted. Well, sort of for the reasons, but for a very specific reason this time. We don't know what Tanner Houck's status is. He last pitched against the Mets on September 4th. So we're going on, what, close to 2 weeks now. They said he didn't bounce back well from that start. He was kind of having some shoulder fatigue. They tentatively said he'd pitch game two against the Yankees series on Wednesday or Thursday night, whenever we last recorded. I think I actually sat out that show, if I'm not mistaken. But y'all made your picks, and Tanner Houck was listed to go for Friday's game. It was a Wednesday night recording. So Houck was set to pitch 48 hours later. The next day, I pulled up the pitching matchups because I wanted to see. I forgot who he was pitching against. And I noticed it said TBD instead of Houck. So I'm like, huh, that's interesting. And I mean, I was kind of somewhat skeptical if he would pitch. So I DM'd Christopher Smith from Mass Live. I said, hey, do you know if anything's going on with Houck? You know, suddenly it's TBD on the site for Friday night. And he goes, no, as far as I know, he's set to go. He had a bullpen session yesterday. They felt comfortable with it. And I'm not positive, but he was in Worcester covering the AAA team. I think he texted either Cotillo or McAdam, and they messaged Cora saying, hey, is he still pitching? Cora said, yeah, he's still pitching. So I had to take it at face value. Okay, all right, he's still pitching. And then 55 minutes exactly before the game was set to start, he was scratched. So still kind of weird to me. But what really pisses me off about it is in late June, early July, he was coming up on his all-time high of 119 innings. And when he pitched those 119 innings, it wasn't even at the major league level. It was in the minors. I forget what year it was, but that was the most he'd ever pitched, and it happened to be in the minor leagues. And I was a little concerned, and all of us were saying, you know, they got to be careful with him. You don't want to redline him. And you look at the job Breslow did last winter. He sent us into the year with a rotation that was not sustainable. Then we get to the trade deadline. You get a guy that blew out his calf. A guy with a history of all kinds of random injuries that probably wasn't going to finish the season. Third start out, he blows out his calf. And then what do we get a few weeks later? We get Rich Hill. So the incompetence with building this pitching staff essentially forced Houck to go out there and still pitch 5 to 7 innings. And he kind of scuffled since mid-July, basically since the All-Star break. You know, we all celebrated how he made the team, and we were kind of advocating for him to start. He didn't. I forget who was the starter, but he did get in the game fairly early, I think. He might have been the second or third guy in. And ever since then, it's been a grind. Every start, well, most of his starts have been stressful. He's labored a lot. The strikeouts had dipped. The walks had risen. And he's got a fatigued shoulder. And they're saying he's going to go on Wednesday against the Rays. But at this point, why would you mess with it? Why you need Tanner Houck in 2025? We waited out this whole year for Giolito to come back. You need Tanner Houck, and you got to go get one more guy, whether that's a free agent or a trade. You can't, like, if you get Giolito back but you lose Houck, you're in the same boat, and you might even be worse, honestly, because Giolito, even when he was healthy those last few years, he sucked. He was a dumpster fire. So the incompetence here from Breslow is just, it's at an all-time high, and you got to shut Tanner Houck down. He should not be starting another game for the rest of the 2024 season, and it's Breslow's fault. And if Breslow wants to start him, Alex Cora needs to put his foot down and say, absolutely not. He's not saying that right now, but he's got 3 days to say that. I don't know if there's a bullpen session planned. There must be. There must be at least one test they're gonna give him, but they didn't send him for images. One of the trainers, apparently his name's Brandon Henry, examined him, did some just touchy-feely tests in the clubhouse or in the training room or whatever. And they're not really looking into it. Shut him down. You've got nothing to gain by pitching him. All right, for once, like in the second half of the final month of the season, do something smart and shut him down.
Jeremy, your thoughts on Breslow and Houck and that whole thing?
Yeah, a lot went into that. I'll try to break it down to three main points. One, Houck should be absolutely shut down, because if he comes out and pitches and gets hurt and affects 2025, the fan base will be fire-breathing dragons. I mean, how could you not? I mean, the sign's there that he's not healthy, and then you go pitch him in a less meaningful game. Like, if you were, his last meaningful start would have been Friday. The season's over. If you pitch him in Tampa and put him at risk, it's negligence. Or it's intentional. Whatever, it's stupid. So I agree with that. With regards to Giolito, and I know Terry only touched on that quickly, but it stuck out to me because what's your expectation with Giolito? He's coming off a major injury. It's not like he's going to step in and throw 200 innings. We're going to be talking about skipping starts and giving him an extra day's rest, and we're going to get some forearm soreness at some point. Like, it's going to happen. So if you think you're just going to plug and play him at 200 innings, you're out of your goddamn mind. And then the big point, which I think was Terry's initial point, but it was a lot more about Hauk, is how can you support Breslow from a Red Sox fan base other than to say it's only been 1 year? Like, that's the best you can do, is to say, well, it's not fair because he's inheriting a lot of Heim's problems, and let him put his own team together here. No. Stop. He built the team. He made the key acquisitions. He built the shopping list at the deadline. No deadline move helped in any way. At 0-4-4, and it costs, what, 9 prospects? Something like that? I mean, what a dumpster fire that was. So that's an F. That is an absolute F. The way he built the pitching rotation, Terry is correct, unfortunately. It only happens, a broken watch is right twice a day. But it wasn't sustainable. You had multiple guys, Crawford, Hauk, that have limited experience pitching deep innings in a season. And then you have guys that every year, it's never serious, but guys that go down. Pivetta, every year he goes down. He's not going to make all 32, 33 starts. It's not going to happen. So where's the pitching depth? Where's the pitching depth? There's none. There's absolutely none. And now you can, now I'm sure some, Terry calls them what, Bresbitarians? They come out and say, well, Dick Fitz. Well, guys, he wasn't even on the horizon until like 2 weeks ago. And the fact that he's pitching the way he's pitching is great. It's unbelievable. But no one in the organization expect him to survive these starts. No one. And anyone that tells you otherwise is completely lying. He has mediocre stuff at best. And if you're projecting him in your starting rotation in 2025, then that's a problem. So we have major organizational issues here. And we haven't even talked about the lopsided left-handed lineup, which we're not going to do because Terry didn't bring that up in his opening statement here. But I like putting Breslow in the duds section in a series we lose to our rival that effectively eliminates us from playoff contention. It makes all the sense in the world to me. And I would think that Breslow is going to get some talking points here on Twitter, Boston radio, and certainly with the beat writers. And if they're not, then I'd want to know why that blame is not properly being assessed.
Three things super quick before Jason gives his thing. They're called Bresbians. They're the Bresbians. Secondly, a broken watch can be right 3 times if it's in the 1 o'clock a.m. hour on daylight savings. Never forget that. And then on a serious note, one thing about Giolito, I have mentioned this. He didn't get full Tommy John. He got the bracing procedure that Trevor Story got and that a lot of position players have been opting for. There's only one starting pitcher in Major League Baseball history that I'm aware of that's ever had the bracing procedure done, and that was Rich Hill. So there's not a lot of data for starting pitchers who have had that exact surgery. And I'm assuming Giolito is going to be coming back throwing 95 to 97, somewhere in that ballpark. Rich Hill wasn't throwing that type of velo after that surgery. He was a curveball guy. So it just adds to my skepticism on how good he's actually going to be next year. I hope he crushes it, but, I'm skeptical.
So you can tell that Terry's on cough medicine with that broken clock thing that he just came up with in the 1 o'clock hour. I'd never heard that before, but that's, I guess it's technically true, but it's, yeah, that was a stretch. So, but in terms of Breslow, it's all fair. And like, what annoys me is, you know, Red Sox fans on Twitter, you know, as I call it, the kids table, who say, well, you can't criticize Breslow after 1 year because you all wanted Chaim fired at, you know, too early. And, you know, look at all the draft picks he did and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, you're the GM of the Boston Red Sox. It's absolutely fair to criticize you after 1 year, especially when, as Jeremy pointed out, he had a horrific trade deadline. It was awful. He got two pitchers who sucked when they got here and then got hurt. So they're out probably for the rest of the year at this point. I don't think we'll see Sims or Garcia at this point because why bother? And then for whatever reason, he decided to go get another catcher in Danny Jansen, and he gave up how many prospects to get him? Like, I'm not sure what that move was about. Like, I don't think he's going to be here next year. Was it four prospects? So four prospects for Danny Jansen. And again, like, are you bringing him back? Probably not. You've got Kyle Teal on the way. Connor Wong's already here. Like, no idea what that move's about. That one still baffles me to this day. Like, you got a right-handed hitting catcher who sucks against lefties. Like, what was the point of that, you know? So his trade deadline was terrible. His offseason wasn't great. And I don't know. This guy's supposed to be, you know, everyone said, oh, well, when he was a player, he was, you know, everyone called him the genius because he was so smart. I'm not seeing it yet. I'm not seeing it. His offseason wasn't good. His trade deadline wasn't good. You know, we don't know about the draft yet, but it just, he hasn't done anything really to, you know, take the team a step forward. They're exactly in the same spot they were last year, hovering around the mid-70s in wins. You know, they're not going to finish last in their division because thankfully Toronto and Tampa were such dumpster fires this year. But by all rights, they might as well. They couldn't even make the wild card in a weak American League, by the way. The American League was not strong this year. Detroit's not a very good team. Seattle's not a very good team. Minnesota's a flawed team, and you couldn't get past any of them. It just, you know, he didn't do enough. And again, like, I'm sorry. You know, you want to grade him after 1 year. What do you look at? The offseason and the trade deadline. Offseason was not good. You know, he did bring in Giolito, but Giolito got hurt. Now, you can't anticipate that, but still, he got hurt. He brings in Liam Hendricks, who we didn't see at all this year. And now, get ready for this, because they're going to let Jansen and Martin walk, because they're not going to pay either of them. And they're going to say, well, we've got Liam Hendricks. He can be our closer next year. Does anyone feel good about that? Does anyone feel good about Liam Hendricks approaching, I think he's going to be 37 next year, who just got over cancer and Tommy John, and he's going to be your closer? Because that's what they're going to try and sell you. Oh, well, we signed that contract because, you know, we knew that Jansen was going to leave, and so we've got Hendricks, you know, ready and waiting. Because they're not going to pay for another closer. They won't. So it's like, get ready for that too. So the offseason was bad, and his trade deadline was so bad. His trade deadline actually put you backwards. Other teams around the league got better. Houston got better. Like, the Yankees got better. Baltimore got better. Everyone around you got better at the trade deadline. The Red Sox went backwards. They got two relievers who lost you games when they were actually out there pitching. Now they're on the IL. And you got Danny Jansen, who has done absolutely nothing since coming here. So far for Breslow, his grade year one is pretty much an F. It's pretty much an F. Yeah, you're in third place, but you really should be in last. You're going to miss the playoffs again. And now you've got Tanner Houck, who's got something going on injury-wise. And we talked about this all year, that the pitching rotation was not sustainable that way because you had so many guys who were going to surpass their career, you know, limits in terms of innings. We knew this was coming. We knew that Houck was going to get burnt out. We knew Crawford was going to get burnt out. We'll get to him a little bit later. Bayo sucked the first half of the year because the Andrew Bailey pitching program of let's, you know, throw mostly sweepers and, you know, take your four seamer and chuck it out the window. That didn't do Bayo any favors. He finally went back to the four-seamer. Now he's pitching better. So that philosophy didn't work. I honestly think at this point for Breslow, the only good move he's made, and this is, I can't believe I'm even saying this, it's Cooper Criswell. He's probably the best move Breslow made. Cooper Criswell won you games this year. He kind of kept you afloat at times when the rotation was injured or, you know, out of sorts or was kind of a mess. Like, he actually kept you in some games. He kept you in it towards the late summer. But apart from that, you know, nothing else worked. Nothing else that Breslow did really worked. So far, year one, you can kind of see why he was like, what, the 11th candidate, 12th candidate on the list. I think it just goes back to what everyone's been saying. And a lot of people don't want to admit it because for some reason in this town, we now like have a sacred cow thing towards GMs or president of baseball operations. Like, you can't talk bad about them, but Breslow has not impressed. And he's really kind of, he deserves an F for the year. And it's just, can it get better? Maybe. You know, maybe get some little more experience. Maybe if he consults with Theo a little bit more and kind of learns a little bit more, can it get better? Maybe. But I'm not feeling good about it. I don't feel good going into this winter. Like, we talk about all these free agents, Corbin Burns, and, you know, they're not going to get Soto, but Burns is out there, Max Fried is out there. You know, there's guys out there they can get. I don't think they can get anybody. I think you're going to see other moves, like they're going to trade for another Isaiah Campbell type. You know, that was one of Breslow's first moves. He traded for Isaiah Campbell. That guy was useless, and now he's gone. Like, he's, you know, wasting away in Worcester somewhere. So I think you're just going to get more of that. So the inexperience really, really showed for Breslow this year, and it was, it did the team in big time.
The term I've used for him for the last few months is it was a science project. That's what it was. He was the guy that was willing to take the job. He wasn't really qualified. You just kind of hoping for the best. And it didn't work out. And they're probably not going to move on from him. But one of your big prospects should be traded this winter to address a need. Should be traded. Do you trust him to get a good return for them? I mean, look what he got for Nick York. York, I was saying he was our best right-handed infield prospect, but that wasn't true anymore once Christian Campbell, you know, emerged. Campbell was in single A at the start of the year, by the way. Like, his emergence, like, was rapid. But you get Quinn Priester for Nick York. I mean, York should have just been in a bigger package for something you needed long term. I don't trust Breslow. We'll see, but
yeah, I mean, there's already, you know, we saw the Ken Rosenthal story about, you know, potentially trading Casas to Seattle for one of their pitchers. And you're right, I don't trust Breslow to get the right guy. He would trade Tristan Casas for like Brian Wu, who, you know, is young and is good, but Brian Wu has like injury problems and would probably need Tommy John the second he steps off the plane in Boston. So that's kind of the way I feel. It's like they need to make big moves. And Terry, you were the first one to say it. You've been saying it all season. At some point, there's going to be a painful trade. And finally, the kids' table side of Twitter is waking up to that. They're like, yeah, we have too many left-handed prospects. We need pitching. There's going to be a painful trade, whether it's Duran, Abreu, you know, it shouldn't be Roman Anthony, but maybe it's Marcelo Meyer, you know, something like that. I just don't know if Breslow is going to get the right guy. You know, we would love to see him trade, you know, prospects for Logan Gilbert or George Kirby in Seattle, but knowing Breslow, he might trade them for one of the Rockies pitchers or something. Like, and it won't be to that extreme, but I just feel like he is going to make a move. It's just not going to be good enough. He's going to get the wrong guy and it's not going to work out. And again, that's where the inexperience comes in. I don't trust Breslow at this point to really make that big move that sends the Red Sox in the right direction. I just think he's going to make a move, but it won't be the right one. So time will tell. It's year one. They're not going to fire him too soon because they don't want the optics, but oof, It's got to be better than this year for sure. So with that, we'll move on to the third dud. So this is my guy, and I'm going with Carter Crawford. And it kind of ties into the whole Breslow, Andrew Bailey thing that they did with the pitching staff this year. So Carter Crawford, you know, at times was brilliant this year, especially early in the year. April and May, Carter Crawford looked like a different guy. He was punching guys out left and right. He was, you know, limiting base runners. He wasn't giving up a ton of runs. And no one ever said that he was going to be like an ace. You know, he's 27, 28 years old, kind of a late bloomer. But for a guy that, you know, we weren't sure what we were going to get out of him. You know, a lot of people saw him as like a bullpen arm. You got a legit solid mid starter, you know, a number three, number four type of starter. But then the year went on, the innings piled up, and Carter Crawford got exposed. And, you know, this series against New York, he gave up two more bombs in the finale. Now, one of them wasn't really a bomb. One of them was a Yankee Stadium special from Gleyber Torres. So can't really fault him for that one. But the Judge home run was, you know, a no-doubter. He gave up an absolute bomb to Aaron Judge, which also can't feel too bad about because he's had 53 of them this year. So a lot of pitchers have done that. But the home run has been a huge problem for Carter Crawford. It has been, and it always will be, because his favorite pitcher is that cut fastball. And when he doesn't locate it, it just floats over the middle of the plate and it gets crushed. He's now given up 31 home runs on the year. 31 home runs in 30 starts. That is not good. So what bothers me about it is I don't hate Carter Crawford. I actually like him. I think he'd be a fine number four, number five starter. The problem is, as Jeremy mentioned before, because of your pitching depth, of which you have none, Carter Crawford is now penciled in to be your number three starter next year. It's Hauk, Bayo, Crawford. And then it's going to be Giolito, and, you know, Pivetta will probably walk unless they bring him back. Like, who knows? But they're already penciling in Crawford as your number three starter next year. That needs to be better. Your number three starter has to be better than Carter Crawford. Like, again, he's fine if he's your number four, number five, but to be your number three starter behind Hauk and Bayo, like, if you go into a playoff series, if you're in the ALDS, Carter Crawford is starting a playoff game, I don't feel good about that. Nobody should feel good about that. And it just speaks to the whole larger problem of, again, you don't have pitching depth. You don't have, you know, a pitcher in the minor leagues that's banging on the door saying, okay, yeah, you know, next year he's going to be in the rotation. You don't have that because the previous guy was too afraid to draft pitching and he just drafted shortstops year after year. And now you have like 20 of those and no pitching. So I don't know if Breslow can fix that. I know he drafted some pitchers this year, but we don't know. Those guys are years and years away unless you get, you know, a genie in a bottle type of thing and you get a Paul Skeens out of nowhere, but that's not likely going to happen. So the Carter Crawford thing, it's a little bit on him because I just think he's average. I don't think he's a top-end starter, but it's also on the organization. Like, this guy, you can't go into next year with Carter Crawford as your number three starter. You've got to do better than that. You've got to get someone towards the top end who can be like a 1-2 with Tanner Houck. And you've got to do it that way because it's not going to be good enough. If you're relying on Carter Crawford for 30 starts next year to get you to the playoffs, it's not going to happen. So another rough outing for him in a game that, again, you really needed and he just couldn't deliver. It's got to be a lot better than Carter Crawford next year. So, Jeremy, what are your thoughts on Carter Crawford?
With regard to his start, not much. You know, four earned runs and four and a third. Gave up six hits. He's got a good whip. His stuff's just not that great, and he gives up the long ball. So, you know, that equates to a low four ERA, which is where he's at. And if I have my way, the Red Sox, Breslow, will go get an ace that is currently outside the organization. And then it's going to be Hauk, Bayo, and Crawford as your four or five, depending on whether you go add an additional left-handed pitcher or you fill that need with the ace. And that is a balanced rotation where you force Criswell to Worcester and you build depth, because to make the playoffs in the big leagues, at some point, you're going to have to rely on a minimum of 7 to 8 starters. So Crawford being 4 and 5 has a trickle down effect of pushing Criswell. If Richard Fitz is still around, that pushes him back down to Worcester where he should be, and gives you two guys that can come up and give you a spot start or long relief, depending on where the roster's at for that particular part of the season. So that was my position a week ago when we spoke about this. It's my position now. And I like the player. I just like him, like you said, at 4 or 5. I don't want him. And we actually spoke about this in midway through the season. We had our projected, hey, if they make the playoffs, who's our rotation? And he was in it. But he's clearly showed that he can't pitch down the stretch. He's another guy that's blown his previous innings in a season away. And I think in large part he's out of gas. So, you know, I don't think you give up on the player, but I think you do reassess his position in the rotation, and that's my take.
Terry.
I'll keep it brief. Pre-All-Star break, he had an even 3.00 ERA. Post-All-Star break, 6.41. And he's actually had some fairly decent starts lately. This one wasn't, as Jason was kind of pointing out, he got unlucky with a few things earlier. Wong didn't come up with a line drive. You know, he had a right field home run that wouldn't have been a home run in probably at least 24, 25 ballparks, or 29. I don't know. It's a pretty short porch out there. But, you know, going through his last 5 starts prior to today, he went 6 innings in his last 3 starts, only gave up 3 earned runs or less. And then before that, he went 5 against Arizona, 2 earned runs in that one, 3 earned runs against Baltimore, and 5 1/3 on August 18th. So, he's bounced back more than Houck was bouncing back, I feel like, before Houck got hurt. But like you guys said, he's a number 4 or 5 guy. And if you go into a season telling us he's a number 2 or 3, you failed. You failed, and we're looking at another season of barely competing for that third wild card again. And I'm sick of the bar being set in that spot. You go back to 2018, you win the World Series. You made the playoffs once since then, and you haven't won the division since then. Here's another thing I just thought of today. This is kind of unrelated, but it just blows my mind. If you signed Mookie Betts to that 12-year deal at the start of 2018, he's only got 5 years left on it, and he's still playing pretty good. So I'm just so sick of the incompetence. I'm sick of the arrogance of the front office. I'm sick of watching guys like Cutter Crawford desperately needing them to be a number 1 or number 2 when you know they're not. And man, I hope they surprise us this winter, but my expectations are pretty low.
I agree. Yeah, my expectations are pretty low too. Some dishonorable mentions before we move on to our studs. So Zidane Rafaela, 1 for 11 in the series with 5 strikeouts. Again, just can't stay away from that strikeout bug that's been bothering him. Tristan Casas, 2 for 10, was also benched against both left-handers. So Cora obviously having some trust issues with Casas. And then Zach Kelly, who's been since optioned down to Worcester, had that really bad outing in game 2, loads the bases, and we all know what happened after he was taken out. So some pretty rough performances, though, guys. Any thoughts on the dishonorable mentions?
Yeah, Boozer. That that grand slam that Judge hit was the most predictable grand slam of all time, with no outs, bases loaded, no outs. That thing was getting torched, and it did.
Yeah, I think we all saw that one coming for sure. So yeah, a lot of stuff to harp on the negative side. There were some studs who showed up, so we will stick to that. We will go on to our stud segment. So, Jeremy, you're up first. Who is your stud of the weekend?
So, Dick Fitz throws 5 innings, 2 hits, 3 walks, no runs, only 2 strikeouts. I think that's the kind of guy he's going to be. He has no earned run average at this point, and his whip is 1.13. And the reason why he is a stud is he gave you a chance to win the game in a vacuum in this series. But as I mentioned in my previous take, I think we have a chance here to have found some organizational depth in the starting pitcher. I think he should be a 7th or 8th guy next season, but we're starting to see where some of these guys, you know, slot in, assuming we go get an ace and a left-handed pitcher and we fill in the 5 that are going to start the season. And that's a good sign because it's September. This guy is making a second major league start. He goes into New York and gives you a chance to win. That's the type of guy that can come in mid-April when, you know, Crawford has a oblique and go give you a chance to win a game and a start or two and then go back down to Worcester where he should be. So I think we might have found with Dick Fitz a 7th or 8th guy that's going to factor in at some point, probably numerous times in 2025, assuming they don't use his increased value to go package him to get a big league piece, which I would be okay with.
And Dick Fitz, still just 24 years old, like you said. So he's young. He's part of your depth. So absolutely want to see more of him going forward. Terry, what do you think about Fitz?
I'll keep this one pretty brief. He didn't check off all the boxes for me, but the one important box he did check off was he could stand on the mound in Yankee Stadium and navigate. And he struck out, I think he struck out Soto once. He definitely struck out Aaron Judge once. The reason why I said he's not checking off all the boxes is because those first two games, like I said earlier in the show, the Yankees were just golfing them. They were just trying to hit home runs. They weren't putting the ball in play. That's why they're not going to win the World Series this year, because their mindset in the batter's box is so flawed. And Fitz kind of benefited from that. I'd love to see him against a Baltimore-type lineup. We're not going to see them again. But here's the thing that scares the crap out of me, and I said this on a recent show. I don't want to go through the winter hearing that he's in the rotation next year. It's too shaky to do that type of a gamble. I think Criswell I would probably, if you can keep Criswell in the minors, I don't know what he's got left for options, but I guess I would keep Criswell, but I would utilize Fitz in the Criswell role. Guys are going to go down next year. Hopefully not for a long time. Hopefully just briefly. And I'd be a lot more comfortable if Fitz was the guy that was called up to make those spot starts, as he has in the last couple weeks. He's still a two-pitch guy. He is working on trying to work in some other stuff, but predominantly a fastball slider guy. So he's still developing, and I don't want him developing in must-win games. I want bona fide major league pitchers to be pitching those games next year. So I think he needs one more year in the minors with some occasional call-ups.
Yeah, that's kind of where I view him. I want him in the Criswell role next year, where he's called up if someone goes down and he makes a few spot starts. But the people that already want to pencil him in as like your number 4 starter next year, like, no. It like pump the brakes a little bit. Don't get me wrong. Like, again, he's 24, decent numbers in Worcester so far this year, not overwhelming ERA, just a little bit north of 4, Not a big strikeout guy, but I still like him. I want them to develop him, but don't pencil him into the rotation. Like, if he comes into spring training and he's, you know, whatever, he's on fire and looks like a totally different guy, then maybe. But other than that, like, I want him just, you know, sort of in that role. Just, you know, keep him in the minors, let him develop a little bit more, and go out and either trade or pay for legitimate starting pitching so that he's not heavily relied on. I think penciling him into the rotation, it's too soon. So he's looked good. He's shown some flashes, but, you know, let's go out and, like, actually get some legit top line pitching. And that way Fitz is more just like, you know, he can eventually work his way in there, because that's how you fix the depth problem, is that you've got this guy who, you know, can pitch in the big leagues. He's just maybe not fully ready yet. So let him develop a little bit more, go out, fill your rotation, either, again, by trade or free agency, do it that way, and then let Fitz kind of hone his craft, really refine his stuff, and when you feel like he's ready, then you put him in the rotation. But doing it, like, automatically, like, again, the kids' table of Red Sox nations, like, they see two starts out of the guy, and like, oh, there you go, there's your next bona fide starter. Like, no, don't do that. It just, you know, give him time, let him develop, and I think eventually he'll work his way in there. So I still like what I'm seeing. I still think that he can eventually get there, but I'm not ready for him to be, you know, opening day, he's your penciled in as your number four starter. I don't think that's not sustainable. That's not the way that their offseason should go. We should expect better. So I like that he's there. I like that he'll be there in the future, but just not right away.
When we acquired him in the Verdugo trade, the prospect analyst said that he had the ceiling of a number four, number five pitcher, but with a high floor. And when you look at his numbers across the minor leagues this year, they're not great. So that leads me to believe that the analysts were probably in the ballpark. So not a guy I want to risk it with next year in a spot that should go to a notable free agent or a notable trade target.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, there's no rush. Cooper Criswell, you've got years of control with him. So we know that you can bring him back. We know that he's serviceable. He can spot start. He can actually pitch in Yankee Stadium and do pretty well. So there's no rush with Richard Fitz, you know. And like you said, if his ceiling is that of a you know, back end starter, then especially you don't want to rush him, because if you do rush him, and yeah, he might have a high floor, but if he's not ready, he could get shelled, and then, you know, he loses confidence, and it's just, it's a whole, you know, mess after that. So I think that they've got a little something there, but just be patient with him. Don't force him into the rotation next year because your GM is incompetent and your owner doesn't want to spend money. That's a horrible excuse to do that. So with that, we'll move to our second stud of the weekend. Terry, this is your guy. Who is your stud?
I'm going with Connor Wong. And, you know, he didn't have a ton of real high spots in the series, but he was 4-for-10, 3-for-4 in the finale. And, you know, he's got his average back up to 287. He's had a pretty good year offensively for a guy who hits somewhere between 6th and 8th in your lineup. And the reason why I wanted to highlight him is, you know, I've been thinking about what next year's team will look like and what the next 3 or 4 years could look like. And I mentioned in the war room, I'm all for trading Marcelo Meyer at this point. And I don't care how white hot he gets next year. I hope he gets white hot, because then he'll have more trade value. But with the emergence of Campbell and the fact that you're stuck with Story anyway, Meyer's my big fish that I'm willing to trade. So Teal's coming up, but Wong has really proven himself to me as a utility guy. And with that bat, that's extremely valuable to me to be able to, especially if you're keeping Casas and you don't know what he's going to be in terms of health. you get a guy like Wong, you could start at first base. You can start him at second base. If Story goes down, I don't know if Campbell can play short, but they've tinkered with him in the outfield. I wouldn't put Wong in a trade package. I want him in Boston throughout his entire, you know, whatever service time he's got left before free agency. He's got at least, I think, 4 years after this one. But I think he's really increased his value this year. And being as weak as we are with right-handed bats, he's just too valuable. And 4-for-10 against the Yankees. And I can see him being a big October guy as well. We saw what Kike did in 2021, probably your best hitter that month in October. I could see Wong having a performance just like that in a big spot. So Wong was my stud.
Jeremy, what are your thoughts on Connor Wong?
I'm a big Wong guy. I have been on the Wong bandwagon the whole season. I got pissed early on and voiced my displeasure on this podcast numerous times when he was losing starts to McGuire. And then they go and trade for a backup catcher that is supposed to be fixing the right-handed bat issue. And I'm like, but you can't take Wong out of the lineup. So it just never made sense to me. And I'm not going to keep hitting on the trade because that sucked. And no one can disagree with that. But then all of a sudden you see that he has this ability to be serviceable in multiple spots. And what does that do is it gives you roster flexibility. I've talked about it all season. It's extremely valuable. You know, he's going to be in the lineup as a right-handed hitter. You can mitigate the wear and tear of catching by putting him at first base once a week, but still having his bat in the lineup. He's an above average base runner. He's not going to go Duran Rafaela crazy on you, but he can go first to third. He can score on a questionable ball to the outfielder on second base with two outs. You can send him. Athletic guy, hits for power. So if Teal comes up and is the guy, I don't have a problem with Wong slipping into more of a kind of a hybrid backup catcher utility situation. At all, especially if that means he's going to get a lot of at-bats, even though he's quote-unquote the backup catcher. The other thing is there's no guarantee Teal is going to be the guy. Can we stop with whoever's pushing that narrative? Like, look, I hope he's the guy, just like I hope every person, every prospect is going to be a guy. But it doesn't work that way. It just doesn't. So Wong's a known commodity. We don't have the luxury to gamble at catcher by moving Wong and having Teal have a setback, have to be sent back down. Maybe he's not quite ready. Again, I hope I'm not saying he is or he isn't, because I hope he's going to be ready and he's your unquestionably your starting catcher for the next 10 years. I don't see Wong as a trade candidate. So I hope he's here and he's continues to surprise me. Every year he does a little bit more and surprises me. I think he's at about his ceiling now. And I'd say let him go do that for the next, like Terry said, 4 years. And then we can assess where he is with regards to potentially signing an extension at some point and then probably starting after 2026.
Just real quick on Teal, I pulled up his numbers. So he's had a pretty good year overall, hitting .285, 13 home runs, 75 driven in, .817 OPS. That's the good news. The bad news is most of that was at double A. He's kind of slowed down a little bit since his triple A call up, hitting .233, still with a pretty robust .362 on base, but only two home runs, 15 driven in. So that tells me I wouldn't expect him to make the team out of spring training, even if he lights the world on fire.
Yeah, I think they rushed Kyle Teal up to AAA a little bit. And I think it was mostly because they wanted to do, it was a marketing ploy. They wanted all three of those guys to go up at the same time. Meyer, Anthony, Teal. Oh, look, they're all going up to Worcester. Like, Teal, to me, you just drafted him 2 years ago. Like, he's he needed more time in Double A. He was doing fine down there. His numbers are good, like you said, but they rushed him to Triple A. And I think now you're seeing that, like, yeah, he's probably going to be good, but let's not say that you've got your next Adley Rutschman just yet. He's not there yet. So in terms of Connor Wong, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that he's had a good offensive year. He's a right-handed hitter. The power has slowed down a little bit towards the end of the year, but he's still getting extra base hits. He can play different positions, and he's got some decent speed. The bad news, defensively as a catcher, he has dropped off a cliff. And it's really kind of surprising because he was up towards the leaders in terms of, like, defensive war a catcher last year. This year, defensive war among, you know, qualified catchers, he's 81st in all of Major League Baseball. So he has taken a massive drop off. He's 42nd in pop time. His arm strength is still good. He's still in the top 25 in that, but the pop time has gone down. The defense has gone down, and you can kind of see it. Like, he's not throwing out runners at the same pace that he used to. He's not blocking balls as well as he used to. So again, he's here, and I think that he's going to be valuable for you down the stretch. I just don't know if he's really an everyday catcher. And I wonder if this is partly why they went out and got Danny Jansen, because Jansen defensively profiles a little bit better at catcher. Now, offensively, he's, you know, nowhere near what Connor Wong can do, but defensively, he's very good. So I wonder if they're sort of hedging their bets. They like Kyle Teal, and they hope that he's the next guy. But as you both point out, like, we don't know. He may not be the next guy. He, you know, it might be a little bit longer for him. So maybe trading for Jansen was a way to get him in here. And then, you know, when the season's over, kind of negotiate a short-term contract with him to stay on. And maybe your catcher tandem next year is Jansen and Wong. And they sort of wait on Kyle Teal to say, okay, prove yourself. You know, if you tear it up in AAA, then fine. We'll bring you up, and Connor Wong can be our backup first baseman, second baseman, whatever, because he is that athletic that he can move around the field, and Danny Jansen's the backup catcher. I think that's kind of what they're angling for, because, again, Wong's defense at catcher has dropped off. It's really weird. He was so good last year, and now you look at where he ranks this year, Reese McGuire is ranking ahead of him. Like, that's how bad he's gotten. So, the defense behind the plate for him has dropped off, and he's only 27. So it's not like the age is catching up with him. He's still a good athlete overall. I just don't think catcher is his long-term position. I think he's more of a utility guy. He's more of like a Russ Snyder type where, you know, he can play the infield a little bit. And then as he gets older, he'll probably be an outfielder, something like that. So still a good guy to have. He's still in his pre-arb years. So you've got years of control with Wong. So you don't have to worry about it just now. And if they do bring Jansen back on a short-term deal, you've got Kyle Teal waiting in the wings. It's not a bad situation to be in. I don't know what Wong's future is in terms of being an everyday player. Because if he's not a catcher, he's not going to play second base full-time. First base is taken up by Casas. So he might just be another Russ Snyder type, but more towards the infield than the outfield. And maybe that's his goal. But still a good right-handed bat. He's still producing offensively. Again, the power isn't where we really want it to be, but that's okay. It's not a deal breaker. He still hits left-handed pitching very well and, you know, delivers offense from the right side of the plate, which this team desperately needs. So I think he's here for the long term. I don't want to trade him either. But I just don't know if he's going to be an everyday catcher going forward. I think he might be more like a super utility guy going forward, just based on the defensive metrics.
I think Teal probably will be up though next year, you know, towards maybe late June or July. So I wouldn't expect the Red Sox to sign anyone to a multi-year deal per se, you know, a one-year deal, and you probably either trade him or cut him at some point. But I think he's close. I just don't think, I think he probably needs another at least 200 at-bats, you know, at the AAA level.
Yeah, I think if they bring Jansen back as a catcher, it's like on a one-year deal or 2 years with an option or something. It's not, they're not going to sign him for 3 or 4. So that's sort of what I was thinking on that one, but we'll see. We'll see what they decide to do. So with that, we'll move on to the third and final stud. This one was my choice. I'm going a little outside the box, but it's only because we rarely give this guy his flowers because he rarely deserves it. But this weekend he did. And I'm going with Dave O'Brien. He was good this weekend. It was probably the most fire and the most passion I've heard from Dave O'Brien all year. And it's not because he made like these, you know, big, loud, great calls or anything. It was just, especially the way when the whole Gerrit Cole, Rafael Devers thing went down, the way that he went after Cole and he went after the Yankees and he went after Boone, just basically saying, look, this guy wants nothing to do with Devers. It's so obvious. And he, you know, he went like Dave O'Brien obviously is always going to keep it professional, but in the most professional way, he called Gerrit Cole a coward on the air and just completely went after him, went after the Yankees too, in general, just saying, look, this is a team that wants to go all the way. And this is how they're playing. Like, it's not going to be good enough. And for a guy who is usually so vanilla and just doesn't give you much, you know, isn't entertaining in the booth for the most part, he showed some fire this weekend. And maybe it's because, you know, he recognizes the team's out of it. You know, people aren't tuning into Nesson as much because there's, especially over the weekend, there's college football on, there's Patriots football on. Like, you know, he's probably doing anything in his power to keep people tuned into Nesson. I just wish he would bring that like all year. You know, that's what Orsillo would do. Orsillo, like, the reason we love Don Orsillo is not because he was goofy and, you know, he did antics with Jerry Remy. It's because Orsillo, when the team was bad, he didn't hold back. He told you, like, look, this is why we're struggling. And, like, the offense is good enough or the pitching's been terrible. Like, he would tell it to you like it was. And then, you know, if the Red Sox were losing 10 to nothing, then him and Remy would kind of break out into antics and, you know, getting into laughing fits. And that kept you entertained because even though the team sucked, you're like, well, I'm laughing with Don and Jerry, so I'll stay tuned in. O'Brien doesn't have that. O'Brien's not funny. He just isn't. So for him to actually bring that out of him and to go after the Yankees the way he did, go after Gerrit Cole the way he did, I liked it. I want more of that. Like, tell it like it is. You know, don't be so afraid to, like, just tell us what we're seeing. Because Red Sox fans are smart. We're not stupid. Like, we know what's going on. We know the team's out of it. We know that, you know, they're overmatched. But just be honest with the audience. That's what they like. So I hope that we get a little bit more out of that. Because, again, we're probably stuck with them. It's just, you know, all the people saying, oh, you know, the first thing the Red Sox should do in the offseason is fire Dave O'Brien and bring back Don Orsillo. Okay, well, that's nice, but it's not going to happen. Like, legally and contractually, that's not realistic. So if we're stuck with Dave O'Brien, can we get the guy from this weekend who was trashing the Yankees and, you know, was honest with his viewers about what was going on in the field? Like, that's what I prefer. So again, we kind of bag on the guy most of the year, again, mostly deserved, but he was good this weekend. He was good in the Yankee series, and I want more of that going forward if he's able to do it. I don't think he can. I think he's too professional, quote unquote, to do it. But every now and then, if he can pull that out, I'd be happy with it. So, Jeremy, how about you? What do you think about Dave O'Brien?
So I didn't watch that Cole Devers exchange live, so I didn't listen to O'Brien. I will say this, and as Terry would say, I'll keep it brief. I always thought, I've never been a hater of O'Brien, because Terry will take every shot at him possible, and I just kind of sit by silently and say nothing. I'll say this. It's always tough coming up after a legend. And so everyone wants the legend back, and they're unicorns. And Orsillo is and was the best. And whoever that was going to be was going to face the highest level of scrutiny you can face for that job. I don't think O'Brien's bad. Is he going to go into a laughing fit because somebody threw a pizza at a fan that played a ball in play and see some goofy stuff in the stands that he know he can't comment on and just go into a laughing fit and while doing it be wildly entertaining. No. But he's not bad at his job, guys, in my opinion. So I've never had a problem with O'Brien. I think the cast of characters that they've rotated in with him, other than Eckersley, has also been a problem. So, you know, it's just not the greatest booth. He's not an electric personality. I do think he calls a professional game. And I don't sit there and watch games on Nesson, of which that's where I watch my games, and think this could be a better product. Trust me when I say, this could be a better product, I'm talking about the on-field product and not who's reciting the events. So that's my position.
Terry, how about you?
I am not going to take the bait that Jeremy just set out for me. But what I will say is, in a losing season, you have to make things interesting. And for one game, it was game, 151, something like that. He made game 151 interesting. And that's my take.
Yep. No, I think that's pretty accurate. You know, again, it was one game, it was one weekend, but it was still good to see. It was good to see a little bit of fire out of that booth. So, and I do agree with Jeremy's point that I think the rotating cast of Euculus, Middlebrooks, Merlone, Millar, like, too many cooks in the kitchen. Just pick one guy, let him develop chemistry with O'Brien, maybe you get something better, but they won't do it.
And by the way, when you have a dry play-by-play guy, you have to have somebody with some humor and personality to complement them. And when you pair him with Euculus, it's just brutal. It's just brutal. Like, that's what made Remy and Orsillo, independently they were great, but together they were dynamic. And I thought that when O'Brien was with Eckersley, that's as good of a booth as we've had since. So why are we not going out and getting a personality? Like, is there no ex-player that has a personality? Euculus ain't it. And I hated Euculus as a player, so I'm already, like, kind of off on him. But I just don't think he's great at it. And he doesn't equate his playing career to the in-game moments anywhere near as well as he needs to be proficient at that job. So that's my final take. Go ahead, Terry.
I'm going to take a little bit of the bait now. Jerry Remy was great, but Orsillo was a big reason why he got there. He was just another play-by-play guy before Orsillo. And then Orsillo just would egg him on and kind of bring it out of him. And then I think after a while, they both made each other better. You know, the last decade or so, decade and a half. And O'Brien's not going to do that, kind of like what Jeremy was saying. You know, he's going to need the next guy to do it. So, to me, the only guy I really like in there is Merlone. I don't know who. Maybe Papelbon. Like, he intrigues me. He's rough around the edges right now, but I think he could be an entertaining guy. I'd love to see him and O'Brien and not have him just be the third wheel. It's never going to be rougher than Johnny Gomes. That was rough. I don't blame them for trying it because I was intrigued by him too, but it didn't work. So I just don't know that O'Brien can do that, you know, and I forget his name, the lead Brewers guy. If you could snag him, that would be great. Kevin Brown is phenomenal with the Orioles. That's a guy I would love to have. And you have seen guys switch. Jason Benetti just went from the White Sox to the Tigers. And I know it's happened at least once or twice. If you want to go with a well-known national guy, Matt Vasgersian makes me laugh my ass off. I would love to see at least one season of Matt Vasgersian if you want a rock star type guy. But, you know, it is what it is. So I'll drop the bait.
Yeah. No, I think at this point, pay Merlone whatever it takes. Just let him do the color full time on Nesson and not have him do WEI as well. Like, whatever it takes. Just pay Marloni, give him the bag, and have it be O'Brien and Marloni full year. Like, no Euclid, no Middlebrooks, for God's sake, no Middlebrooks. And no more Kevin Millar. Like, it was cute at times, you know, reminiscing about the team. But if I have to hear, well, you know, look at the back of the baseball card one more time, I'm going to lose my mind. So just pay Marloni the bag. Let him be the full-time color guy. Let him develop some chemistry. Maybe you'll get something. Who knows? But they probably won't do that. It'll be the same rotating cast of God knows who next year. So we got one good weekend out of O'Brien, but that'll probably be it. So with that, we will wrap up this episode. Keep an eye out for our series prediction show. We'll be giving our predictions for the Rays series coming up this week. And then we have another episode of Hot Takes coming your way as well. So some interesting ones coming through on Twitter this week. So should be a good episode. Keep an eye out for that. And we will talk to you guys later. Take care.